one of the most charming and interesting events on the national dining calendar. Charleston, South Carolina, that is, Food and Wine Festival. It's going to be in its fourth year in 2009. The dates are in early March, and we're featuring because it's just such an absolutely terrific event, and of course we plan to be there. So we've invited Erica McMillan, who's the media marketing manager for the festival, to join us on the menu to tell you all what it's all about and get you interested in going, because you'll have a wonderful time.
Well, I love it. Erica, tell our listeners what it's all about.
This will be the fourth year, as you mentioned. The dates are March 5th through 8th, 2009. It is a weekend of gastronomic delights. It's everything you can imagine from our wonderful local chefs here in the Lowcountry. We bring in guest chefs also with winemakers and authors and put on over 50 events throughout the whole weekend. Everything, the party kicks off on Thursday night with our opening night party. It's a salute to Charleston chefs. 19 of Charleston's best restaurants all under one roof, celebrating everything that we love about Lowcountry cuisine. That is a great way to start your weekend and to get into the mood for the festival. We then roll into Friday. We'll begin the day with our opening ceremonies, where one lucky person will win the chance to cook on stage with our headlining chef this year, Bobby Flay, from the Food Network. After that, our Culinary Village and Grand Tasting Tents will open that afternoon from 2 to 5. That features two Grand Tasting Tents, the Charleston Club and the FedEx. Both have a combined total of over 70 food and wine vendors, all serving samples of their varieties of specialty gourmet foods and drink. So that should be a great afternoon. Also included in any of the Culinary Village ticket, because that also takes place on Saturday and Sunday, there will be cooking demonstrations, a Iron Chef-style cooking competition. BB&T, our naming rights sponsor, will host a hospitality tent. All kinds of exciting things going on, so you'll definitely want to check out who's doing demonstrations and cooking competitions. We'll also have a grilling station this year, which is new, so you can find all of that information on the website very soon. And again, that happens Friday afternoon, and then there's a Saturday morning and afternoon pass, and then one all day Sunday. So that is the hub of the festival, and definitely don't want to miss that. We do a King Street Sip and Stroll, which is, King Street is famous to Charleston for its shopping. All along there will be 15 different stores hosting a winemaker, and guests will be able to shop, taste different varieties of wine. There's a different winemaker in each store.
Oh, wow.
Some of the stores offer a special incentive that afternoon, so it's great. Girls love that event.
Yeah, I was going to say, girls, listen up. This is where you get shoes.
Guys, keep your lady friends away from this street, whatever you do.
Yes, you definitely, you know, hopefully you'll get to do some shopping while you're here in Charleston, and that is what's so important to the festival, is that you come in and you get to eat this amazing food, but you also get to have a feel for Charleston City and the culture and the history and what makes our town so famous.
Now, are you having the wine reception at the Art Museum again this year?
No, not at the Art Museum. We have a couple new wine events, one that we do every year and have continued to do. It's very popular. Again, it's a great way to get to see Charleston. We do a winemaker reception in a private home. There are five homes, historical homes, all each hosting a chef or caterer and a winemaker. So you get to go in and just get a feel for the unbelievable architecture that's here in our city. And so that's a great event that actually takes place on Saturday. New this year also, on Friday afternoon, is a boating event, which we're very excited about. You get to get out on the water, which, again, is why people love coming to Charleston. It's Cocktails and Conversation, hosted by Charleston Yacht Charters and the CBB, and it will be a two-hour event out on a yacht where there will be food provided, wine, there will be cocktails, and the editors of Southern Living, the editor emeritus and the new current editor, will be there talking about the hot trends in Southern, you know, Southern Trends.
Great. Now, one of the big events in the whole calendar is the Dine Around, which I believe is on the Friday evening.
Yes, and we
invited two of the chefs who are participating in the Dine Around to join us today so that they could tell us a little bit about what the adventure is going to be like at their place of business. And first up is Chef Kevin Johnson from the restaurant Anson, A-N-S-O-N, a longtime favorite in Charleston. Kevin, welcome to On the Menu.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about what's going to be happening at the Dine Around at Anson, because it's not just one event, I believe it's two.
Well, the Dine Around, it's just another way to feature the restaurants of Charleston, but it's also a great opportunity not only for our guests at the restaurant, but also myself and our staff, because each restaurant, each local chef is paired with a national chef that comes in, and the two chefs and their staffs will collaborate on a five-course menu for that evening, all paired with wines with each course.
Now, who's
it really allows both the local chefs to showcase their talent, but also to bring in a guest chef from the national stage to collaborate with, and it's really a treat for not only the guests but for the local chefs.
Yeah, the chefs love it. They love
it. It's a lot of fun. It really is.
Now, who's coming into your...
We have Alexandra Guarnaschelli. She is the chef at Butter Restaurant in New York.
Right.
All right.
Very good chef.
So that'll be fun. Huh? I believe that there are two different wine programs. Am I correct there, Kevin?
Yes, we're actually featuring two wines. We're going to be featuring Falcor from Napa, California, and then also Shug Winery from Carneros, California. We will have one floor featuring Falcor and the other floor featuring Shug.
Now, what's it like when a famous chef like that comes in? I mean, do you just sort of stand back and just wait to be told to boil things, or
there's a certain amount of respect. I mean, certainly, you know, the national stage versus, you know, us little local guys. But there's a certain camaraderie in any kitchen, and a certain amount of respect.
Of course there is, yes.
Once that tie has, you know, once the relationship is established, they're really just a coworker at that point.
Now, you'll have your menu planned out long in advance, I guess, right?
We would hope so.
You don't have it yet?
Not quite yet.
We
tend to, we're a very, you know, the Anson restaurant is it's a low country inspired cuisine, both in cooking techniques or in ingredient structure. So at this point, I'm really starting to contact some of my local farmers and purveyors, and to see what kind of products they can somewhat commit to for this first week of March, and then we'll kind of base our menu from there. Let them start with the idea, and we'll finish it off.
Now, will the winemaker be coming in ahead of time also to figure out which things are going to go?
Yeah, we'll typically meet either with the winery or a representative thereof, and also get that into our mindset as well. So as we're, you know, as we kind of hit the ground running with the idea structure, we kind of, you know, we'll have those wine pairings in the back of our mind as well at all times.
Now, you've done one of these before, right?
Yes, we did it with Hugh Atchison from 5 and 10 in Athens last year.
Yeah.
Okay, had you done it? Was that the first time?
Yes.
Okay, so it was good fun, huh?
Oh yeah,
and everybody who came had a good time.
I believe so. Yep, we had a wonderful time.
You know, I want to mention something. I mean, you say us little local guys, dining scene in Charleston is fairly substantial one. You know, great chefs down there, and it's great food.
We tend to think so. That I'm from the Virginia area originally, but spent time in Charleston in the mid-90s and then moved back to the D.C. area, but knowing full well that the Charleston was going to be my home more than likely forever, just because of the identity that it had been establishing at that point, and now really what I think is more and more people are finding out about.
Great. Well, I know it's going to be a great event. I don't know. Now, we're on the menu certainly planning to be in Charleston for the event. Well, whether we'll be coming to Anson at this point is really too hard to tell, but it's important for listeners. Erica, just give listeners a reminder for how they would sign up for the Dine Around, and the fact that perhaps...
And do it fast.
And do it fast, because there Now, people in Charleston know they're good food,
yes,
so they're going to fill up fast.
This year, for the first year ever, we have a total of 18 dine-arounds. We typically have only 14, so we've added four new ones to our event schedule, which is great. 10 of those 18 are already sold out. Some of them don't open it to the whole restaurant. Anton, for instance, and Tristan, they do the entire restaurant, where some will only do part of it. So those tend to sell out quick, but all of these will be sold out mid-January. So anyone interested will definitely want to go to the website at charlestonfoodandwine.com, or they can call 843-727-9998 extension 4, and we'd be happy to help. The menus that you were also talking about with Kevin will be available mid-January online. So you'll want to go back after you've bought your ticket and check out what you're getting to eat.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kevin. And I'm sure we'll see you around during the festival, even if we don't have the pleasure of joining you for dinner.
Of course. Look forward to seeing you. Thank you.
Now we're joined by Aaron Deal, who's the chef at another wonderful restaurant in Charleston called Tristan, which is participating in the Dine Around. But the Dine Around event there is going to be a little bit different. Explain why, Aaron, or explain how.
Peter, thank you for having me. Yeah, we're actually doing the first vegetarian Dine Around of the history of the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, which is going to be super exciting. We're bringing in Jeremy Fox from Ubuntu in Napa Valley. He is running now a all-vegetarian restaurant, and which is connected to a yoga studio out there. And, you know, he's garnered rave reviews as well as a Food and Wine Best New Chef title in 2008. So, you know, we're thrilled to have him here at the restaurant, Tristan.
And what do you think? Is that going to be of particular interest, do you think, Erica? Have you gotten feedback from people that said we wish this was available?
You know, we did have a lot of people that enjoy vegetarian dining and were excited because the tickets are selling, and we've gotten great feedback from people who are thrilled with the option to be able to dine in vegetarian style. And really, if you look at the menu from Jeremy's restaurant, it's unbelievable cuisine and the type where you're not going to even notice that you're missing the meat. So we're excited, and we can't wait to see what turns out.
Now, Aaron, this is going to be quite an adventure for you. I'm guessing you have vegetarian options, but you've probably not done a whole five-course meal of vegetarian before.
Well, you know, to me, serving vegetarians or pescatarians or anyone of the like it's a real challenge, and I think it's a lot of fun to do. And we actually have a vegetarian menu at Tristan, you know, so if everything goes right, the hostess finds out this information before they even sit down, so we're allowed to offer them a menu that they can choose anything on and not have to worry about it containing any type of meat or, you know.
And not just boiled veggies, right?
I'm sorry?
And not just boiled veggies.
No, not just boiled veggies.
And tofu turkeys and things like that.
I'm not sure what a tofu turkey is.
we cooked one once for a vegan relative, and you just don't want to know.
That sounds delicious.
Now, is there wine pairing? There's wine pairing as well. Now, must be quite a challenge with an all-vegetarian menu, isn't it, to do wine pairing?
You know, you would think. We're actually going to be using, featuring Willa Kinsey wines.
Oh, great. They're from Oregon. It's wonderful stuff from Oregon.
Right. It's going to be very, very nice. And I tell you, you know, it's not that daunting of a task. You know, vegetables have flavor just like anything else, whether it be, you know, a sauce that is prepared from the base of, you know, a meat product. You know, it's actually very exciting, and I think it's going to be very innovative because you'll be able to get some of the things, you know, depending on the area that the wine and what produce comes from that area or is really featured there, we'll be able to play with that. So it should be a lot of fun.
Now, you're going to be searching out for some special regional ingredients, just like Kevin said he was doing?
Yeah, you know, when you are doing something like a vegetarian menu, you know, obviously the cost is going to be a little, you know, different because you're not using, you know, proteins as your center of the plate that typically run more expensive than produce. So we're able to actually source out different products from around the country and around the world that are very specialty in the form of spices or vegetables or, you know, anything and everything that we can find that's really going to set this apart.
But you'll have a lot of vegetables in season already by March, correct?
Yeah, sure. There should be a good amount coming into season, especially with spring on the way.
I mean, it's because of some of the local vegetables are some of the things that we enjoy the best about dining in Charleston. Sure.
And not only will we feature local vegetables, but at the same time, we want to bring in those things that might be new to people who haven't experienced something in this area, that would really set us apart from anything else that they've ever experienced in their entire lives.
You have an example of one that you can mention?
You know, there's this really special herb that's grown on top of the mountains in Switzerland. I can't think of the name on it right now, but we'll be using, similar items.
Well, that's great. Well, that's yet another option. And listeners, if you've never tried Willa Kenzie wines from the state of Oregon, trust me, if you opt to go to Tristan, you won't be disappointed, because they're both our Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris are absolutely terrific wines. And maybe we'll stop by for a glass, even if we don't dine there.
And Peter, just so you know, those wines will be featured, but a winemaker from all of the wineries at each dine around will be present at the dinner, there to talk about their wines and how it pairs with the food, and they'll be on hand.
Oh, sure. Well, we went 2 years ago to the one that John Besh cooked I forget the name of the restaurant, but John Besh from New Orleans was there. And,
sure.
And the wines were some excellent wines from California, and indeed, the representative made comments about them. So it made it a very interesting evening, but it was also a very jolly evening. And listeners, just as a last reminder here, you might think, well, these sound like they might be awfully stiff events, but they were really rollicking, great parties. We had a wonderful time. You should pick yours, and let's just do the website and the telephone number one more time.
It's charlestonfoodandwine, spelled out, one word, .com, or you can call at 843-727-9998. Extension 4.
Erica, thank you so much for joining us on behalf of the festival, and Kevin Johnson from Anson and Aaron Deal from Tristan, thank you for joining us also.
Thanks, Peter.
Bye.
And we look forward to seeing you in March.
All right, you too. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Don't forget to email us at any time, the address, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And we'd love to hear from you. You could even say happy holidays. Jingle, jingle, jingle.
Jingle, jingle bells, jingle bells. Oops, you were singing earlier on, and we really need to make sure that doesn't happen anymore. Yeah. The next band up is very interesting. Those of you who follow the wonderful world of food science and great guys like Harold McGee, and our recent interview with Dr. Hervé Thies in Paris, the book we're talking to David Joachim and Andrew Sloss about is about pure science, the physics and chemistry of food preparation, and an extraordinarily detailed reference book.
And straightforward, easy to understand.
Yeah, and he's a nice, straightforward, easy to understand
nice
guest,
guy.
Too.
Just, so let's just listen to him.
Just a fascinating guy. So
here we are.
Up?
Dave Joachim, did I do that right?
Yes.
Oh, good. You've written a gazillion cookbooks, but we're going to be talking about one in particular, which was a real welcome entry to our bookshelf, The Science of Good Food, and is subtitled The Ultimate Reference on How Cooking Works. You wrote this with Andrew Schloss, who we know well, with A. Philip Handel, Ph.D. And so we are expecting this is going to be immaculately authentic and accurate. My first question is, why with all these books out there on the subject of food science, did you decide to write another one?
Well, we thought there really weren't that many books out there. You're probably familiar with Harold McGee's book on food and cooking,
which broke ground
in this area a couple decades ago, actually. And there are a few other books out, but we thought there really wasn't a good book that is a reference book that is easy to dip into and dip out of to find the one thing that you're looking for. So let's say you're in the middle of a recipe and something goes wrong and you want to know why or you want to know how to fix it. This book is set up from A to Z with more than 1,600 entries. So you can just look for exactly what you need. And we thought that there was room for a food science book with that kind of focus.
Can you give us an example, David?
Let's say that you have a cake that has failed. Maybe it's a recipe that's been in your family for years or generations, and something has been going wrong with it for you, and you're not sure what. We have a troubleshooting chart in the cake entry. So if you turn to C in the A to Z format of the book and look up cake, there's a chart on troubleshooting cakes with lists of problems, like the cake doesn't rise or it falls or the top of it burns or the batter overflows from the pan. And then there are lists of possible causes related to those problems and then potential solutions for those problems.
And another example, can you think of
some? Yeah, I see it. That's very useful.
Yeah, you have another rescue method like that?
Yes, actually throughout the entries, the particular topic at hand is discussed at length. So there are remedies within many, many entries. For the cake entry, we thought it was particularly important to draw those out into a chart, since so many things can go wrong. And a lot of them have easy fixes. For instance, many home ovens are way off from the temperature that is reading out on the dial. If you have an old dial style, often those dials are loose or the oven is not calibrated correctly. And even if you have a digital readout, your oven may not be calibrated correctly. So that can cause many baking problems, particularly with cakes, which are very sensitive to heat. So you know, we recommend putting an oven thermometer in your oven. We have an entire entry on ovens discussing the differences among convection and when you might want to use that as opposed to leaving it off. So the book is really intended to make you a better cook by knowing the science behind not only the ingredients you're working with, but the techniques that you're using and the equipment that you have at hand.
Now let me test you out here, David, because our stove doesn't like to work very well, but if you hit it in just the right place, you can get the controls to light up again. Now, is do you have that kind of advice?
This is a time-honored mechanic's remedy for many problems with machines. Sometimes things do get stuck, honestly, just from the repeated use of a machine. I'm not sure what kind of stove. Is it electric or gas?
It's the piece that doesn't work is the electronic controls. And I have been known, and listeners, you might be amused by this, I have been known, and my friends know this, to bring out a hammer. I put the hammer inside a potholder so they won't break the enamel on the stove. And sometimes it's enough to just carry that close.
With electronics, you know, the wires can become loose, and often establishing that connection is a matter of jiggling it so the wire is touching what it needs to touch. So that will often solve the problem.
I mean, I don't even dare to jiggle it. Now here's another test for you. This is a famous story. This is a family recipe, and in this particular family recipe, which is for a sirloin tip roast, the family recipe said you have to cut the tip off the roast, put it on the side.
Okay.
And we wondered. Now the lady was telling the story. She wondered for years what it was about this, what was the science behind this that made it work. And then she finally discovered, as her grandmother was dying, and this is almost the last piece of useful information, the reason that they did it was because they didn't have a pan that was big enough.
That's good. I like that.
But it was
sorts of adjustments need to be made all of the time, and that is often a big part of cooking, is not being a slave to the recipe and knowing that. If you have this kind of knowledge that this book provides, let's say you love meat cookery and you love roasts and grilling and whatnot, if you read the meat entry, you will get such a foundation of knowledge that you will no longer be a slave to recipes you may have been following, and you'll realize, I don't need to do what it says here. I can change the flavor profile. I could roast this instead of indirect grill it, for instance, or vice versa. If I have a wonderful roast that I like in my oven in the kitchen, but I want to do this outside because it's summertime or I'm entertaining outside, I can do this outside with an indirect grilling method.
Yes, and you have the science behind that in your book.
Correct, yes. There is an entry on grilling.
And you also have recipes, and you have kitchen wisdom, which a whole bunch of nifty little things like take covers now, now what I'm looking at.
Here's the $64,000 questions he used to say. How did you find all this out, David?
Well, my background and Andy's background converge wonderfully. He has a long background in food product development, which requires a lot of science know-how. I have a long background in healthy cooking and food production. So a lot of the book's information on animal husbandry or healthy cooking or antioxidants and the effect on our health, those sorts of things come from my knowledge base and the more, I think, most of the chemistry comes from Andy's knowledge base. But we both have a pretty broad experience and knowledge in those areas, so we each contributed to those areas, but those are our strengths.
And
I think it's kind of unique because we're both cooks. I am more of a writer and Andy is more of a cook, but we're both writers who cook or cooks who write. So that helped us to take this science that we know from experience and from reading lots of studies and doing lots of research and just experimenting in the kitchen, to take that and explain what's happening in very simple terms. That was the goal of this book. You asked, you know, how does this fit in with the other books that are out there? Well,
it's easy, but it's not superficial, is it? I mean, it's very accurate and in-depth.
There's very detailed information. We use all the appropriate scientific terms and whatnot, but we wanted to make the book approachable for the home cook who may have no interest in science,
right,
but they want to know how to cook better. And our view is that knowing the science behind what you're doing can really put you in control and make you a better cook. So being able to explain those principles in layman's terms, I think, is invaluable to someone who just wants to know how to get dinner on the table, for instance, or to make a really beautiful menu for people that they're entertaining.
Now, who is Dr. Handel?
Dr. Handel is the director of the culinary program and food science program at Drexel University. So he reviewed all of our material to make sure that we didn't gloss over any of the science, because we were trying to simplify many principles of chemistry and physics. And he vetted the manuscript, and he also helped in some of the development of the manuscript, but mostly he read the manuscript to make sure that the science was accurate and complete and not misleading, because when you're simplifying, you do have to shorten things, and in some cases, he made suggestions that really helped the entries because we had kind of shortchanged the issue and glossed over some things that were important to include.
Well, that's terrific. Now, the book just happened to fall open at an entry in the H's for horse. So let's go with that for a second.
Okay.
Let's just suppose that a four-legged creature just happens to collapse outside your house, and it looks like it's available. Where do we go from there?
Well, that's funny because we're doing some horse recipes in our next book. Andy and I are working on a book, a second book about grilling called it's basically on ingredients, and particularly ingredients that Americans might not eat as much. Horse is one of those. Horse is fairly popular in other countries.
We're very familiar with that. In fact, we were in Puglia in Italy, and I guess they have two kinds of butcher shops.
One is an equine.
And one is equine.
And the other one's cavallo, and we never found out what the difference was. They both means horse.
Yeah, well, horses, it's one of those meats that I don't think Americans will ever embrace.
Like puppies. The addition to equine and cavallo, we found an entry on a menu in Sardinia for Grand Prix.
we never could understand that. We could never figure out why the fast horse didn't get away. but listeners, you got a chance here. You get some horse that comes by.
About all these kinds of scotches. I thought we were pretty well up on scotches.
Yeah. I mean, you cover beverages as well. I mean, there are seven kinds of Scotch whiskey, and you researched all of those too. How long did it take you to produce this book, for heaven's sake?
Well, from the time we conceptualized it and started to come up with the format for the entries and wrote it, it was about 3 years from beginning to end. But we spent almost 6 months just coming up with the format for the entries. And we had originally conceived of these as mini-essays. And they still are mini-essays to some degree, but we've broken them up so they're more easily accessible. So you've noticed that each entry is broken into a section of called What It Is, and then a section called What It Does, and then the last one called How It Works.
And that allows
you to dip into, if you're looking for a definition, you can look in What It Is. If you want the deep science, you go to How It Works.
Uh-huh.
And if you're looking for kitchen tips and, you know, how it really affects you in your everyday cooking, then you go to the What It Does section. We had originally come up with a different format, and once we got through about a third of the writing, we realized we would have about a 2,000-page book.
Yeah.
So we had to scale that back. We collapsed some entries into other larger entries. For instance, we had entries on every type of nut that you can imagine. So we collapsed that into an entry on nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some sacrifices made to make the book practical in that way, because we know people don't want to buy six volumes like the OED. But that format took about 6 months to hammer that out, and then it was another 2.5 years or so of writing.
Now, another thing you do very well, I think, is you have an extensive cross-reference.
So if you don't hit
quite the right word, there's a good chance that the other five words that are cross-referencing it will take you where you need to go.
I thought that
was really good.
So I'm glad that that's working, because that was very deliberate, because we collapsed so many entries. And let's face it, things don't exist compartmentalized in the world. They all exist together. Things are happening all together.
Yeah,
you've got meat, and you've got a grill, and you've got flame, or maybe you may have gas, you may have charcoal. Well, all of things are happening at once, whereas in the book, we break them out into an entry on meat and a separate entry on grilling, and a separate entry on oxygen, and all of these things are related. So the cross-referencing in the book is very important so you can see the whole picture.
Yeah, maybe it was the grilling book, because it was pretty thorough, too. Maybe that's when we interviewed you.
That's possible. That is also focused on the science of grilling.
Yes, that's
that,
it.
That must have been.
That's it.
That must have been what it was. Yeah. The interesting thing is that I discovered by trial and error your hot side, cold side grilling method.
And
I now teach that famously to everyone I teach how to grill, and I seem to have taught quite a lot of people, including our son and our friends we just visited in Spain.
That is something that expands the possibilities of your grill greatly. Most people are so used to just putting food right over fire. And if you move it away from the heated portion of your grill and cover your grill, then you're really turning it into something more like an oven,
right,
where the heat is, convection heat currents are rolling around the food and cooking more gently, which allows you to sear a roast, for instance, and then move it to the unheated part of the grill, cover it, and slow cook it for as long as you need to the doneness that you prefer.
Now, you remember, sweetheart, Michel Nichard, who's an old friend and a great chef, and very much into healthy cooking, and he told us that, in fact, if you keep the meat or the fish on the hot side of the grill and you get flames and all the fat burns, that's really very unhealthy
he said it's
dangerous, and not only is it dangerous, the other thing I discovered side by side with that is it also makes it not taste very good.
Yes, that is the sooty aroma that you get on grilled food that has been cooked directly over high flame with a lot of fat. There are a number of things you can do to minimize that. You can trim the fat. You can cut the food into smaller pieces so it spends less time over the fire.
But there are a
number of compounds that are created when fatty food is cooked over high heat, and particularly over an open flame. And we can minimize these, like I said, by using kebabs, for instance, because the food is cut into smaller pieces and cooks more quickly. But you can also reduce it by marinating. The American Institute for Cancer did some research and found that the formation of these compounds is greatly reduced just by marinating meat, and that's particularly helpful. So it's true, if you cook directly over the fire, there are some potential health risks involved, but there haven't been enough studies done to come up with a limit for people. It hasn't been considered such a risk that a limit should even be established. It's more so one of those proceed with caution kind of cases.
Now, how soon will you have to update this? I mean, how fast are we moving now? I mean, everything gets changed so much. Harold McGee took 20 years to update this book.
Right. Well, A lot of the chemical principles don't change.
Okay.
You know, what happens to meat when it cooks, for instance, how the protein is denatured by the heat and the muscle fibers shrink and squeeze out the water, and how the connective tissue dissolves into gelatin, creating that wonderful mouthfeel of what were once tough cuts of meat like chuck roast, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Becomes wonderfully gelatinous and tastes tender in the mouth. Those chemical principles don't change. But a lot of the information, for instance, we were just talking about grilling and how it affects your health, studies are still ongoing of those things. So most of the information about how food affects humans, that kind of information needs to be updated. And the other information, which is the bulk of the book, about the chemical and physical transformations that happen when food is heated or when certain ingredients are mixed together, those are a little more, those have more staying power. We're still finding out more and more, but that information has a longer shelf life.
Well, David, we thank you and Andrew and Professor Handel as well for contributing this wonderful addition to the cookbook collection that we have. We do recycle some. This is one we're not going to recycle. It belongs on the shelf, and it'll always be available as a reference. Listeners,
glad to hear that.
It's called The Science of Good Food. You'll be able to buy it through the OTM bookshelf. David, I won't even do your last name and learn how to do that. I didn't. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being a part of On the Menu. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And when you have another book out, we'll have to talk about that too.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. Bye.
And now we will take time for a commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again on the menu. And as promised, we're going to be interviewing a couple of people coming up now. They could be really great presents, unexpected presents for the holidays. The first one is so adorable, you have to see it to believe it. Let the founders, the inventors, explain it to you. It's the Alligator.
Listeners, if you have not yet heard about the Alligator, you're going to hear about it. And we're going to actually introduce it to you today. We have the co-inventors. We have Bill DeHaven and Micah Burton, who dreamed up this wonderful, it's so adorable, the Alligator. One of you, please, describe what this is. What does it look like?
It's a gadget or a device that is used. The initial idea was that it used to retrieve items that have fallen into a garbage disposal or other uses. Basically, it's a handle, a trigger-activated tip. The tip looks like the jaws of an alligator, hence the Alligator. And there is a high-intensity LED light in the tip. And the handle unfolds sort of like I hate to use the analogy of a gun, but it has a handle and a barrel and then the tip at the end and the trigger activated. You squeeze the trigger, it activates the tip open and closed, and it can retrieve. The tip is serrated and grooved, so it can get anything from a wedding band to a twist tie to a lemon seed and a shard of glass and many of the other uses.
And many of the other things that I've found in my garbage disposal.
What were you dreaming about when you invented this? It's not an intuitively obvious invention.
Well, this is Micah speaking, and I had the initial idea, although to say that we are co-inventors is totally accurate because we have been partnered from the beginning. When my now 9-year-old son was an infant, a toddler, I used to clean the sippy cup valves, these little plastic things that would remove, and I would always clean them by hand in the sink because I didn't trust the dishwasher to get them clean enough. And they were kind of awkward to handle, and I was always scrubbing them, and they were always falling into the disposal. And I have this real, I'll call it a dread, a fear of putting my hand in the disposal, and what would happen in that remote chance if those blades start whirring.
I have the same feeling.
It's absolutely, you know, to the depth of my core, the fear, and I hated it. And I researched, and there was nothing that could do it that solved that problem. And I thought, well, it's really simple. All you need is a little device to spread the rubber flaps, and then you need a light, and you need a grabber.
And so that's how it came about. It really is a very simple and basic invention. We're not geniuses. We're just smart.
Well, now, what did you do before?
Yeah, you must have had a day job, Micah.
Perhaps you still have a day job.
Bill, yes. Tell us what you do for a day job.
Sure, but I have actually been working full-time to manifest the Alligator. Style was very important when it came to the Alligator. We wanted something that was visually appealing as well as functional. It's designed to pick up small things that are, you know, relatively close. It's one of these things that, you know, the garbage disposal is a perfect use for it because nobody likes to put their hands down there. It's disgusting as well as the fear factor.
Were you a designer or an engineer?
I'm an engineer, yeah.
Okay.
So I made several prototypes in my basement. I have a wood shop. And then I branched out and made some out of polycarbonate so they would be clear and I could be testing the light and so forth. And then from there we went and got a CAD person to make up some drawings for us and then it was many iterations there to get what we wanted.
Now, you have found since it's debuted, first of all, you're getting an awful lot of ink and air on about this. I mean, people are fascinated with it.
Yes.
And you found that people have found other uses for it other than what you intended.
Yes. When we sort of came up with a list of other uses initially because we had the problems, like in between the car seat and the console is a perfect place. certainly, you know, under and around furniture, if you've ever tried to get something that's under the couch where you can't see it, but you need a light, you need something to hold up the fabric on the cushion, and then you got no hands to go down in there. The Alligator's perfect because it's got the light and the grabber all in one. But some of our customers have called up. I had one person who, she's a custodian, and her vacuum cleaner, for some reason, has this little piece of metal that catches the stuff. She had someone make her little piece of metal hook that she'd been using. She saw the Alligator, and instantly she said, that would be perfect. Now she's
a custodian at an elementary school, and it was paper clips that kept getting stuck in her vacuum. And now she has the Alligator, actually, she has a device where it's permanently attached, it's rubber banded to her vacuum, and she can just pull it out and get those paper clips out of her vacuum.
One of you mentioned grapes, didn't you?
Grapes?
I thought one of you said grapes, or maybe I thought of that.
Fantastically, wherever they might fall. It also is great for grabbing bugs in the house. I'm
that
a
was
catch
the one.
And release kind of guy. I don't like to, you know, I don't want to kill the bugs. You know, we get these little stink bugs here in Pennsylvania. You go up and grab the bug and throw them outside.
I was asking, what are stink bugs? I'm in Pennsylvania. I don't know what those are.
It might be an Eastern Pennsylvania thing. They're like, I don't know, they look like tanks or something. I mean, they've got these hard shells, and they seem to come into the house in the fall. And
sounds like a Japanese beetle or something like that.
It's kind of like that, but not quite as colorful.
And if you squash it, it stinks.
Oh, dear.
Oh, there you go.
That's what's called a stink.
Well, horrible. We had a woman who doesn't even have a garbage disposal buy one. She said she used it twice in 1 week in her car. One time some French fries fell to the side of her car seat. And she just reached out and pulled them out. Another time, she was going to an appointment, and she was putting on her lipstick. The lipstick fell down to the side of the seat. She just pulled out her Alligator and grabbed it.
But she'd have to have an Alligator. She'd have to have an Alligator along. I suppose what happens if you really drop things a lot is you would need several.
Exactly. Well, that works for me.
Now, how much does this retail for?
For $19.99 plus shipping handling on our website.
And that's on your website. Now, can you buy it other places, or if not, just give us the website so people can know how to get it.
Sure. Well, our website is www.alligetter, which is alligetter.com.
Two T's, E-R.
That's right. And it's also available at Improvements at the Improvements catalog, which also has an online website, but they have a catalog.
Is that home improvements?
I'm not sure if it's home improvements or if it's just improvements.
Oh, okay.
Improvements catalog.
Okay, now we've got to be careful here, I know, because you're not going to want to give away any trade secrets or new inventions that are coming up, but having produced an Alligator, you must have some other wonderful ideas in the future for what will add to your portfolio of products.
Bill loves to sit in his workshop and come up with Alligator 2.0, all these different versions. There's an extend. I should let you talk, Bill.
Sure. The Extendigator, an extendable version. We're going to incorporate on the Getter theme, and work a stylish work our stylish magic on a whole slew of Getter type devices. We found that there are some good Getters on the market, but there's nothing that is fun to use. I think one of the things that we've captured with the Alligator is it's fun to use, it's fun to have around, it's fun to play with, and that makes for a very compelling design that people want to use. They like how it looks, and they want to use it.
I just thought it was cute. Once I thought, I like the light best of all.
Well, everybody's got to get one, guys and gals.
That's right.
Now, is there hope that this product will be available on the export market in order to reduce the U.S. deficit and allow listeners around the world to get one?
Sure. Anybody can go to the website. We will ship. We'll ship planetary wide. Right now, we're focused on the United States because the United States has the largest by percentage number of garbage disposals in homes. They're not as prevalent around the world. But as the other uses become more prominent and better known, we'll sell to anybody.
Well, right now.
I want to expand on. I'm sorry, Bill's. Bill's a point about it being fun. It is very functional and very practical, and I must say we worked a number of years on this. It really does work. It's very, very well designed. And what we have found is we go to homes, we do in-store demos, we're out and about showing it. People will use it. Wow, it's great. It worked in a disposal. And then as soon as they take it out of the disposal, they start playing with it. They start grabbing things that are appropriate or inappropriate.
Oh, I think we're not going to go there.
We're not going to go there, but they love picking other things up, playing around with it. It really is a fun item to have around the house.
Now, Anne was exactly like that. I mean, she couldn't figure out how to make it work.
Oh, I did.
And then the next thing was, how do I turn the light on? And we have indeed been playing with it. We're going to have to get one each. Thank you so much for your wonderful invention.
Micah, it was wonderful talking to you.
I would like to mention, because I'm the sales manager, Bill, the Alligator makes a great gift. We have found it on our website. It's up to now nearly one half of all orders are for more than one unit, and we've contacted some of the people, and they've said they are buying them as gifts because it is new and innovative. There really is nothing like it available on the market, and they're great stocking stuffers for the holidays or just any time you need a gift. It's a great item.
I agree, absolutely. It's a really wonderful present.
Yeah, great timing, guys, and it fits
in a stocking.
Yeah, and have a happy holiday season, and we hope you get a lot of orders.
I hope it really takes off. Thanks for talking to us.
It was
fun.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Okay, and now it's time to take another pause for the cause, and we'll hope to talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And once again, here we are. You're listening to On the Menu. And we have, I would say the books are always great presents, even a little bit different. A magazine, a subscription, is something that keeps popping up as a reminder of the person who gave you a gift in the first place. And we have a really sterling recommendation in that connection. Let's talk to editor of The Art of Eating.
Ed Baer, I have a question. Why are all the great people that I've been interviewing from Vermont. I better back up and say that Ed Baer is the publisher of a really splendid food dining magazine called The Art of Eating. And it's been going a long time. It's been going since 1986, you said?
It is, has, yes indeed, 1986. The first issue appeared in November.
I see. So it's an anniversary of sorts, I guess.
We're in, I guess this is actually the 21st year.
Oh, wow.
Right about now, we're entering it.
Now, why did you start this magazine? You know how we heard about it is a chef we know out of the blue just said, you have to get this magazine. And so that's how we heard about it. And that's why I looked, I went to the website and so forth and so on. And why I asked for sample copies, and why I was really anxious to interview you about it. What made you start this magazine? What did you do before?
Well, I had been, it's kind of a funny story, but I'd been a carpenter. I was a sort of a back-to-the-land person in Vermont, like lots and lots of other people. And lots of them became carpenters. And I did that and built a few houses for about a dozen years. And I wanted to do something more with my mind. I always say that a carpenter needs to know an enormous amount, but on any one day you don't need to know very much.
But as they say, a Jesus was a carpenter, so it must be a decent profession, huh?
There we are. An honorable profession and a good one and an interesting one, and it's a beautiful thing when you're on a Vermont hillside framing up the second story of a house in June, looking out over the view, but it's not so much fun in January. Anyway, I thought it was pointed out to me that I was more interested in food than I knew, and then I began to think of opening a restaurant, which was, fortunately, I didn't do it because I would have lost a lot of money.
There you go. Fast. So you had a small amount of sanity.
Exactly. And I had a friend who had begun a building trades magazine at the time, at the very end of a dirt road where he had brought in telephone but not electricity because the telephone poles were smaller and cheaper. Uh-huh. And he was a great hit, a big success, and moved to town and had an office in electricity, and I thought I would do something with food. Of course, my idea wasn't nearly as lucrative as his, and it was a long, slow start, but that's how it began.
Now, Ed, I have to remind you that On the Menu needs you to speak a little louder because we're speaking to the world.
Okay.
There we go. Now you did it for me. Well known. But how did you get involved in a passion for eating as a carpenter and as someone living in rural Vermont? Perhaps that's a better question.
There's no good explanation for that because carpenters, well, they eat a lot, but maybe not so well necessarily, and not a lot of great food, or there wasn't at the time a lot of great food in Vermont. There were the seeds of change. I'm told that my family is very interested in food, but I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't conscious of it, and it wasn't expressed in any particular way, except they would talk about...
Well, now, we got a couple of sample copies from you. You publish four times a year, and you publish a magazine that has an incredible amount of detail in it. I mean, what are you trying... Do you have a particular mission in mind?
For sure. I don't know that I didn't at the start, but it became clear to me that I was interested in taste, in eating, and not cooking, though we do have recipes, and that my primary interest was the connection of the way things taste to the place they come from, food and wine. So it's a magazine about taste, but it's a sort of a geographical magazine about taste, at least when we're at our best.
Now, that explains the emphasis on geography. Yeah, I can see it now. So how would you describe this magazine to somebody?
There's no advertising.
Yeah, well, that's the first thing of note, yes.
For people who are very passionate about food and want generally a fair amount of information, but whose passion really is about eating and about taste. So it's, usually 48 pages of pretty solid information and hopefully well-written and easy to take in.
I think that the high quality of the writers is important. And where actually do you get your writers?
Good question. We've slowly accumulated writers over the years. It began with friends and then people approach us out of the blue or know somebody that really knows a topic and we approach them in the hope that they'll write. But it's not the most easy, obvious thing.
Uh-huh. Now, as we told you, we already used some information out of one issue when we were in Paris, and we set off to find Andouillette. It was a no-name restaurant, so I don't have a clue if it was a good one or a bad one. The original question I asked you was, why do all these people that we interview that are so wonderful in the food world, why are they all in Vermont?
Good question. I have to stop and think. It's partly that you know, there are two big cities, and one of them is New York. It's 5.5 hours from where I am, but a lot closer to southern Vermont. And it's a big food town, and Vermont is a good country refuge from the big city. I think that's one thing. Also, once upon a time, not now so much, but the land was cheap, so somebody wanting to farm could afford to start farming in Vermont. And there is, it's rural in a way that makes you think about nature and perhaps about growing food and about what you eat.
You know, we had Allison Hooper.
Yes.
She's the one that, she actually
cheese
just
maker.
Won. Yeah, she just actually won. That's Vermont butter and cheese. She just actually won five awards at a big cheese tasting in Ireland.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we interviewed Crescent Dragon Wagon.
Yes, not originally from Vermont, but I guess
no.
She's here now.
Well, not only that, but she inherited somehow a property that serves as a guest house. She has places to put people up and big entertaining spaces because it was some relative that liked parties. So what I want to do is get everybody, all these people we've interviewed, the yogurt people, the buffalo yogurt people, and a whole bunch of people, and we didn't have a party. I think that would be a great idea.
Big food party on a farm in Vermont.
We just were staying with friends in Paris who have a house in Vermont. They have an apartment in Paris. And they just rave about it. They're really from Philadelphia.
Well, it's a
lovely place, and there's more and more interesting food, more and more market gardens. The quality of the cheese has steadily increased over the two decades or so that really people have been engaged with farm cheese making in a serious way. Meats, all kinds of things now.
Now, how do people get your magazine?
The easiest way is to go online to www.artofeating.com, and it's also sold in some newsstands, certain Whole Foods, certain other stores.
And what's coming up? What's the next thing?
What is coming up? Now you make me pause. We're doing a piece on American pork. About 10 years ago, 1999, I did a fairly in-depth piece on Iowa pork about a guy named farmer named Paul Willis.
Oh, yeah, we know him.
We know him.
We know him very well.
You know Paul.
Yeah, we know
absolutely.
Him. We interviewed him, and then we ran into him at the Fancy Food Show once at the Nyman Ranch booth. Yeah, he's a character.
The importance of that article was that a guy named Steve Ells read it, and he was the head of Chipotle Foods. And he stopped buying commodity pork as a result, began not buying pork from Nyman and other more humane, natural sources. And he's now buying something like 50,000 pounds a week of Nyman pork.
Wow. Amazing.
So I'm revisiting this.
All right.
We're also writing the same issues divided between that topic and an investigation of the new American charcuterie, sort of the wave of charcuterie which didn't exist here before.
Paul Bertoli, and then who was it we interviewed? They were in some place funny. Making.
We actually talked to somebody in Vermont. I forget.
It's
Vermont Bacon and something or other company.
Oh, yes, Vermont Smokehouse.
That's it,
Vermont Smokehouse, right.
Yeah. In fact, what we're really concentrating on in this issue is the more cooked things as opposed to the cured things.
I see.
More pâté, terrine, and so on.
Well, it's all very exciting, and I think, listeners, that this is a book that you can keep around and refer back to and enjoy reading at your leisure. It's not one that you just sort of buzz through and throw out.
No, this is
try to do timeless.
Uh-huh.
But this is not a trivial magazine. And this is not Gourmet or Bon Appetit or any one of those other splashy magazines where when you read the article you're dissatisfied at the end because you think you didn't learn anything new. This is quite the opposite, and it's really dense. It's really very difficult to rush it off.
Yeah.
We haven't finished reading either of the issues that we got yet.
Well, I've
oh, you have. Okay, I haven't.
Anyhow, Ed congratulations, and please keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
And, again, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Okay. See you at the party.
Yeah, have a great day, Ed.
Yes, thank you very much.
We'll see you at the party. Bye.
Sounds great. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, you just blink and another program's done.
Yep, so it's time for us to wrap up this week and say we hope to see you again.
And I say
yes, it's cold, but we hope to see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.